Welcome to the class of 2011. Now, for those of you who are here over the summer, I spent time throughout each summer orientation kind of welcoming the class, and I started a little bit of a competition among the different groups. And there was one group that was louder than the other two summer sessions, although I hear the Hawaii group was actually quite enthusiastic. So, can I hear from the class of 2011 again? Very good, very good. All right. My name is Rob Kelly. I'm the Vice President for Student Development. And on behalf of everyone here at Seattle University, welcome. We are thrilled that the class of 2011 is here. All right, good. A very special welcome goes to our families who are here with us today. And I know there's a couple of families I met this morning who were not here over the summer. So they're getting to see and experience all of this as new folks. This moment is very special. It's special because it's the official welcome of the entire class. So we have all of you here, finally, and we've been really excited. And you are large, you're smart, you're diverse. So large that everyone does not even fit into the same room. So let's wave to all the folks who are in the South Court watching this on television. So let's wave to all of them, and they'll be able to see you, hopefully. Now that you know that I'm excited, I want to hear from the folks who were here over the summer. Can I hear a round of applause from the summer folks? Okay. Now, if you did one of the excursion, the hiking trips, the leadership trips, the connections or beginnings, can I hear from you? Can I hear from the parents alone, just the parents? There are some real excited people to get you guys out of the house. I just want to say that. So, welcome to Seattle University. This is the Connolly Center. This is the North Court, and some of you are in the South Court watching this. And one of these days, we're going to blow the roof off this place because this is the home of the Seattle University Redhawks. As members of the class of 2011, you will have the distinct privilege of meeting more of our Jesuit community, more of our deans, directors, faculty, staff, and people who are going to introduce you further to the university. You've already met the people in the red polos, the OAs. A little round of applause for the OAs. And the people in the black polos, the RAs. You met many of them this morning if somebody is checking in. All of these student leaders are excellent resources for you, so please take advantage of that. I'm going to have the opportunity to speak with you a little bit later, and I'm going to introduce someone really important, the littlest Red Hawk, I'm calling him. So he'll get to meet the parents in a little bit later, but many of the parents who were here over the summer got to meet Alex, my son, and he's here. He's back today, back for orientation. He's going to be starting the freshman class in 2025, but he will be here soon. But let me introduce the most important person, the most special person of the day. And it's Father Stephen Sundborg of the Society of Jesus. He became president of Seattle University in July 1997. He leads a comprehensive and independent university of over 7,200 students, undergraduate and graduate, and law, and over 1,000 faculty, staff, and administrators. Since becoming president, Father Sundborg's key objectives have been to encourage a student-centered education, enhance our academic excellence, and develop resources to support our growing student population. He is strongly committed to the ideals of social justice, Division I, a core value of Catholic education, and he actively supports and encourages students, faculty, and staff to be all that they can be. He has even bestowed honorary degrees on people like Nelson Mandela, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and Corazon Aquino, just to name a few. Father Steve grew up in Alaska. Any Alaska people here? All right, very good. And he is the 21st person to serve as a president of the university. So, a round of applause for the one, the only, Father Stephen Sundborg.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Seattle University. It's simply great to see you again. Many of you I had a chance to see over the summer. I've been moving through the group of people today, saying hello to as many as I can. My year begins with this event when our students come and we have an opportunity to start off the university. It's hard to be a president of this university without the energy and the commitment of both the students and their families. They're the people that give us the life for what we do. I'm sorry that we're not able to all fit within this North Court. When we build our sports center and our events center, which we're planning, then we'll be able to have all of the students of Seattle University in one place. I believe that today is a day that all of you will remember for all of your lives. This is a very personal kind of a day, either the day that you began college, or the day as a parent, or maybe as a brother or sister, that you gave a word of support and confidence in the student that was beginning at Seattle University. So this is a very personal day, and I hope that as president of the university that my remarks this afternoon will fit the character of the day. This last June at commencement time, I listened attentively to what parents said to me about their student who was graduating from Seattle U. And several of the parents said this: "I'm just so grateful to Seattle U because I am proud of who my daughter, my son, is. I'm so proud of the kind of person that they are." They did not say, "Thank you, Father, for making my son or daughter to be who they are." They did not say, "I'm grateful for who my son or my daughter has become." They didn't say, "Thank you for a great education." They didn't say, "Thank you for a training that opens up a career for my son or my daughter." But very simply and very clearly, and I believe more importantly, they said, "Thank you, Father. I'm so grateful to Seattle University because I am proud of who my son, my daughter, is." So I want to talk this afternoon in welcoming you to Seattle University. I want to talk around a set of stories about welcoming you into what I call the educational home for who you are. Seattle University as the educational home for who you are. And I'm going to tell you a series of stories. The first is the story of the founder of the Jesuits, Ignatius of Loyola. The year is 1521, and Ignatius of Loyola in northern Spain was wounded in a battle, and during the time of his recovery, he read romantic novels and he read the life of Christ and the life of the saints. And in the course of reading them, he noticed that the joy that he experienced in reading the lives of Christ and of the saints lasted while the joy that he had in reading these romantic novels disappeared after he closed the book. And so Ignatius decided that where he wanted to give his life was to give it in service of God, to be like one of the saints. Ignatius was finding who he was. He was finding a home for who he was. He went and he lived in a cave for 11 months in prayer. He traveled to Palestine to be in the Holy Land. He went and studied in northern Spain and at the University of Paris. He gathered around him seven other companions. He worked in a hospital for the incurables in Venice in Italy. And then one day, as he was coming toward Rome, he had the experience that God placed him with Christ, and that Christ said to him, "I want you to serve us." And after his long journey, Ignatius of Loyola was home. Ignatius of Loyola knew who he was. And that knowing who he was so powerful that it gave birth to the Jesuits over 450 years later. The question I ask you is, what will be the home of who you are? And can Seattle University be the educational home of who you are? That's the first story, Ignatius of Loyola. The second story is one that comes from a poet named Denis Levertov. Denis Levertov was born and grew up in London, but then came to the United States and in the last years of her life lived in Seattle and has these wonderful poems about the incredible presence of Mount Rainier when you can see it and even when you can't. And one of her poems is the following. It's called Evening Train. An old man sleeping in the evening train, face upturned, mouth discreetly closed, hands clasped with fingers interlaced. Those large hands lie on the fur lining of his wife's coat he's holding for her, and the fur looks like limp dog, docile and affectionate. The man himself is a peasant in city clothes, moderately prosperous. Rich by the standards of his youth, one can read that in his hands, his sleeping features. How tired he is, how tired. I called him old, but then I remember my own age, and I acknowledge he's likely no older than I. But in the dimension that moves with us, but itself keeps still, like the bubble in a carpenter's level, I'm 14, watching the faces I saw each day on the train going into London and never spoke to, or guessing from a row of shoes what sort of faces I'd see if I raised my eyes. Everyone has an unchanging age, or sometimes two, carried within them beyond expression. This man, perhaps, is 10, putting in a few hours most day in a crowded schoolroom, a lot more at work in the field, a boy who's always making plans to go fishing his first free day. The train moves on through the dark quite swiftly, with its load of people, each with a conscious destination, each with a known age, and that other, the hidden one. Except for those still young, or not young but slower to focus, who haven't reached yet that state of being which will become not a point of arrest, but a core, around which the mind develops, reflections circle, events accrue, a center. A girl with braids sits in this corner seat, invisible, pleased with her solitude. And across from her, an invisible boy, dreaming. She knows she cannot imagine his dreams. Quite swiftly, we move through our lives. Swiftly, steadily, the train rocks and bounces onward through sleeping fields, our unknown stillness holding level as water sealed in glass. That dimension that moves with us, but itself keeps still, like the bubble in a carpenter's level. You know, that level that a carpenter has, that block of wood, long, and then the clear glass with the oil in it and a little bubble, so that when it's level, the bubble is right in the center of the glass. The bubble in the carpenter's level. That's who you really are. That's your core. That's your center. That's your stillness. That's the you around which reflections grow. That's the you that needs to be educated, that balances and guides your life. It's the bubble that popped into being sometime and that you always carry with you. My question to you is, what is the hidden age of when you are, when you became who you are? What age is the core, the center, the bubble in your carpenter's level? How will you educate that center? How will this university be an educational home for the hidden, true you? The third story is my own. I believe that I must have been about 11 years old, and I recall sometime around that I was standing in my room in Juneau, Alaska, where I shared a bedroom with my older brother, and there was a dresser drawer there, and it was my dresser drawer with my clothes in the various dresser drawers, and in the top drawer was all my neat stuff. There was my slingshot and my pea shooter, my cap gun, my holster, my camping knife, my salmon eggs, my glow-in-the-dark crucifix, my rosary, my compact Bible, my Eskimo yo-yos, my baseball mitt, my prayer book, my holy cards. And I remember once looking at all that stuff, and it just came to me that this is my stuff. This is not my brother's stuff. These are not my parents' things. This is my drawer. And I realized I am who I am. I'm me. I have my own life. There's a top drawer to me also, the true drawer of who I am. It's the bubble in my carpenter's level. I'm an 11-year-old boy in Juneau, Alaska, and that's the me that needs to be educated. Denise Levertov allows that there might be a second age in which you have this stillness that is like the bubble in the carpenter's level. I think I had a second one. I was 18 years old. I had joined the Jesuits and gone into the seminary or the novitiate on a hill in Oregon in the Yamhill Valley. I'd been there 10 days. I had my cassock and my cincture and my cap. I'd learned how to pray. I had 50 new companions. I was part of the tradition of the Jesuits. I wanted to be a saint. I was part of a great ambition. And I remember one evening, 10 days into the Jesuits, 46 years ago, looking out over the valley and saying, I'm home. This is me. This is who I am. The other bubble in my carpenter's level is being a Jesuit. I'm still that stillness, and it's the true me, the only me, that can really be educated. It's the core. It's the center. It's the stillness that moves with me in my night train. Again, how about you? What is your hidden dimension? What's your hidden stillness? And can Seattle University be a home, a welcome, an education of who you really are? Who's the real you that needs an education? The only you that can make an education real, because it's the stillness to which an education can stick. Everything else moves, but the true you is a stillness to which an education can stick. It's my third story. My fourth, a little humorous, it's about my mom. Almost 2 years ago, my mom died. She was 100 years old and 6 months. lived here in Seattle. My dad is now 94. They were 8 years apart in their age. He married a much older woman. He was 25 and she was 33 when they married. Imagine that, back in 1938. And they lived here in Seattle. And for the last 4 years of her life, my mom was in a wheelchair. And for much of that time, she was a little bit foggy about who was who and who I was and where she was and what was in the backyard and what she was seeing and what was going on. And I used to go every Sunday afternoon and visit my parents there in their house. And they sat for hours and hours and hours every day in a den. And my dad sat in his stuffed chair with his newspapers and read them, sat next to the window. And my mother sat sort of in the middle of the room in her wheelchair, and the nurse would come in once in a while with juice or something and help her. And she would sit there, and I would come, and I'd pull up a chair, and I'd sit next to her. And one Sunday afternoon, my mother whispered to me with that sort of stage whisper, "Steve, I think I'm going to marry that guy over there." And I said to him, "Mom, you don't need to. You're already married to him." And she said, "I am?" I said, "Yes, you've been married to him for 66 years. And she said, "Does my mother know?" And she pointed to my dad, hoping that he wouldn't hear. "Yes, Mom, your mother knows." Even in my mother's fogginess, when she wasn't quite sure what was what, there was still a core, a center, a hidden stillness, a bubble in her carpenter's level that gave her balance, and she knew who she was. Somehow, in all that muddle, she knew that she belonged to that guy. She wanted to marry him. When everything else goes, there's still who we are, whatever cage we were when we came to know it. So again, can this university be the educational home of who you are? And can you educate the you that will still be your core, your center, your truth when you are 99? My last story, after first Ignatius of Loyola, and then Denise Levertov, and then me, Steve Sundborg, and my mom, is Bill Gates. Bill Gates is worth about $50 billion. He and his wife are, I guess. And they have a foundation that's at least worth that much also, the largest foundation in the world. And he's the co-founder of Microsoft. And he went to Lakeside School here in Seattle. In fact, I was at an event that he gave a talk there, and he ended the talk by saying that because he loved Lakeside School so much that he and his wife were glad to make a gift to Lakeside of $40 million. Nice gift. Any one of you want to do that, just stand right up and I'll take it. And then he told some stories. He said when he was a senior in high school, this other classmate of his, a guy named Paul Allen, they were seniors at the Lakeside School, and the school bought a computer, but they didn't know how to use it. So Paul Allen and Bill Gates, they got the instruction manual, and they took it home, and they read it, and they figured out how to use the computer. And then the school learned that they knew how to actually work this computer, so the school said, "Well, would you set up the class schedules for us, please?" And Bill Gates told this crowd at this event where we were, where we gave the $40 million, that he set up the schedule in such a way that he had Friday afternoons free. And he was always in the class with the girls that he wanted to be in class with. And he mentioned, as a matter of fact, he says that when he was a senior, that his senior English teacher talked him into turning out for the class musical, the school musical play, and he got the co-star role with the person he fancied to be his girlfriend. And he said, I invited her to the senior prom, and she turned me down. And she's here. And you know who you are. And you turned me down when I invited you to the senior prom. And I just want you to know that I've almost forgiven you. That's Bill Gates. And Bill Gates this year was invited back to Harvard because he went to Harvard and he dropped out because he got fascinated with this thing called software. And he went and founded what became Microsoft. And so he was invited back this year to receive an honorary doctorate. And when he gave his talk, he said this. He said, what I remember above all about Harvard was being in the midst of so much energy and intelligence. It could be exhilarating, intimidating, sometimes even discouraging, but always challenging. It was an amazing privilege, and though I left early, I was transformed by my years at Harvard, the friendships I made, and the ideas I worked on. But taking a serious look back, I have one big regret. I left Harvard with no real awareness of the awful inequities of the world, the appalling disparities of wealth and health and opportunity that condemn millions of people to lives of despair. I learned a lot here at Harvard about new ideas in economics and politics. I got great exposure to the advances being made in the sciences, but humanity's greatest advances are not in the discoveries, but in how those discoveries are applied to reduce inequity, whether through democracy, strong public education, quality health, or broad economic opportunity, reducing inequity is the highest human achievement. I left campus knowing little about the millions of young people cheated out of educational opportunities here in this country. And I knew nothing about the millions of people living in unspeakable poverty and disease in developing countries. It took me decades to find out. Shouldn't Harvard students learn about the depth of global poverty, the prevalence of the world in the world of hunger, the scarcity of clean water, girls kept out of school, the children who die from diseases we can't cure? Shouldn't the world's most privileged people learn about the lives of the world's least privileged? His core, his bubble, his center is not being the richest person in the world. The center, the core of Bill Gates is that he is one person of equal worth to every other person among the 6+ billion people of the world. Bill Gates knows who he is. He has often said, every single person I see is just as great a value as are my 3 children. Bill Gates knows who he is. But he says that his university did not educate that core, did not educate that center. It took him years later to find out who he really was. If you came back to Seattle University 35 years from now and gave it a commencement speech at your university, and you were to say how exhilarating it had been to be a student at Seattle U. But then you were to say, but I had one great regret. What would it have been? Would it have been that somehow this university failed to educate who you really are? Failed to be the home of your core. I want to return to the comments of parents and what they say to me at commencement time. Again, what they say to me is, I am so grateful to Seattle University because of who my daughter is. I am so grateful to Seattle University because of who my son is. Let's be clear. They're not saying that Seattle University made their son or daughter to be who they are. No. They're not saying that this university gave their son or their daughter their values. No. They're not even saying that it is what opened up their careers. They're saying Seattle University was a home too. Seattle University educated who my son and my daughter really is, because it honored, it respected, it held sacred, it left real freedom to, it allowed to emerge, it informed and it gave confidence to the center, the core, the stillness, the truth of my daughter and my son. And so I'm just so proud of who they are, because they've lived in the educational home of who they really are. And I hope this day, this very personal day, a day that every one of us will remember for the rest of our lives, I hope this day that as I welcome you to your new home, that I am both welcoming you and promising you that we will indeed be an educational home to who you are as students, as parents do, who take this as a sacred trust, as do we. This is a story that I'm only given one of these in a lifetime. You only get one story like this in a lifetime. This is a parable. I was given a parable once in my life, and this is it. And a couple of years ago, I told this story, and then I decided that people so much wanted to hear the story that they said, Father Steve, would you tell that story? And I said, no, I'm going to tell it once a year, and only once a year, and I'm going to tell it that afternoon when the students and their families are together and they're beginning college at Seattle University. And if you want to hear it, well, you've got to become an OA and come back the next year. Or you've just got to come here, because you're not going to hear it another time. It's the only time you get to hear it is now. And I should tell you that this summer, by the way, I was out hiking, and I climbed Granite Mountain, and it's a 3,800-foot elevation. And I got to the very top, and of course, I don't wear this when I hike, folks. I look like most people look like when they hike. And I got to the top, and there was a group of people up there at the top. There's kind of a fire watchtower at the top of Granite Mountain, perched right on the top of the rock, just with a perfect panorama of the Cascades. And this man said, "Oh, you're the guy that you're the president of Seattle University. You're the guy that told that story about the hike last year when we brought our daughters to Seattle U." He said, "I can't remember your name, but you're the one that told that story about the hike." And I said, "You're right." He says, "Well, my daughter's named Samantha Galvin. And is Samantha Galvin here? Stand up. There's Samantha Galvin. Give her a hand." And he said, "My daughter is named Samantha Galvin, and she just loves Seattle University, and she's an OA at Seattle University." "Well, Samantha, you got a great dad. He can't remember my name. He can't remember anything I said except this story." Well, here it is, folks. And take it as a parable for the next 4 years of your life. Not just you, students, but also you, family and parents. A couple of years ago, it was Labor Day weekend, and I wanted to take a hike. Now, I want to end my remarks today by a final story. It's sort of like, you know, people take their dog for a walk. Well, every once in a while, I, as president of the university, need to take my mind for a walk. Let it out in the air. Let it run a little bit. Get it off its usual kinds of closed-in, cooped-up way of being. So I was going to take a hike. Well, it just happened to be that this was a rare Labor Day weekend in Seattle. It was 90 degrees in Seattle that weekend. I said, no problem. I'm going to take a hike, and I'm going to take a good, vigorous one, because I really need to let my mind soar. So I took my trusty blue day pack, and I made a sandwich with whole wheat bread and non-fat turkey and non-fat cream cheese. Ha ha, great stuff, you see. And one little can of apple juice and some trail mix and a low-fat granola bar. And I chucked it into my bag, and I prepared this great big water bottle that had a strap that would go on your belt. And I had on my walking shorts and my shirt and a cap and my hiking boots. And I got in the car, and I drove out into the Cascades to this favorite hike of mine. And you go off I-90 about 45 miles out there, and you drive in about 5 miles to the trailhead. And I got to the trailhead, and I was so excited about this hike, and I got out of the car, and I threw my car keys in the backpack, and I put the backpack on my back, and I went to reach for the water bottle, and it wasn't there. And I could see it on the counter back in the kitchen. I'd filled it, but I'd forgot to bring it along. And I said, I am not driving back to that or any place else to get water. I'm going to go without water. It's only 90 degrees. This is a 4,000-foot gain in elevation hike. 3 miles, 3 hours in, 2 miles out, 5 hours. I mean, they say you need water, but do you really? I mean, you're not going to die or anything. I'm just going to go for it. So I headed up the trail, and I was chugging along. And I'm one of these guys, you don't want to hike with me, because there's no small talk. I had no one with me to small talk with. I'm all by myself. But anyhow, I go steady. I put one foot in front of the next, and I just go. And the pace at the first 100 yards is the same as the pace at the last 100 yards. I just go. And so I started up this trail, and I'd gained about 1,000 feet in elevation, and I was clutching up. And I was getting worried. And I said, oh, I know. He said, I've got this can of apple juice in that backpack. So I took off the backpack, and I got out the can, and I looked at it, 4.5 ounces of apple juice. I said, great. So I took it down like that, and I'm walking along the trail, and I happen to be carrying this little can in my hand, and oh, boy, 500 elevation gain further, I said, I'm not going to make it. I know what I'll do. I'll beg for water. I'll beg for water. So I keep going. Along comes this couple coming down, and I say, excuse me, but can I have a word with you? I said, I forgot to bring along any water, and would you have any water? Could I borrow any water? And the first person said, well, we're not so sure we have enough for ourselves. And the second said, yeah, we have enough water. I see you got that little can there. Why don't I fill that up for you, and why don't you drink that down? And then I'll fill it up with you for you again, and then you can take it with you. It was a pretty good deal. So I drank the can of water, and she filled up the other 4.5 ounces. Filled it up again, and I took it with me, and I'm walking along this trail. Here I am walking along this trail with this 4.5 ounce can of water, and suddenly the sky is bluer and the air is fresher, and the pine trees have a greater scent to them, and I can see the ruggedness of the rock wall across the gorge clearer and more sculptured than ever before, because I'd taken this hike many times. And there's a song that's beginning to sing itself in my heart. All because I'm carrying with me a 4.5-ounce can of water that I begged. And I hike on for about 1,000 feet elevation gain more, and I said, I got to try it again. I said, well, let's try the old trick one more time. Here comes a couple of people. I said, excuse me, but could I have a word with you? I said, I forgot to bring on any water, and could I borrow some water? I said, if I'm going to give it back, could I borrow some water? And the first person says, well, I'm not so sure that, you know, we have enough for us. And someone says, oh, yeah, we do. And I says, well, why don't you do this? I've got this little can here. I said, why don't you fill it up, and I'll drink it down, and then why don't you fill it up again, and I'll take it with me. That's the old 2 cans of apple juice water trick on the trail thing, you see? So they did that, and I headed on, and I was getting up there now, and I think I'm going to make it. But I got within about 500 feet elevation gain from the summit, and I said, I'm cranking up. This is just not working. I got to do it one more time. And here are these two women. They're coming down. I think this is going to be a long shot because, boy, they have got a long way to walk still. I said, excuse me, but could I have a word with you? There's something about me that sort of intimidates people on trails, by the way. And I don't wear this, remember. You got to imagine me looking somewhat normal as I can look. And I said, excuse me, but can I talk with you? I said, I forgot to bring along any water. Could I borrow some water? And this lady, first one says, I'm not so sure we have enough. The other one says, yeah, of course we've got enough. And she says, but all you got there is that silly little can. I said, the little can's not so silly, lady. But no, I didn't say that. I thought that. At that point, she takes off her backpack, and she takes out of her backpack a liter of plastic bottle of ice water with this huge chunk, like a glacier of ice in the middle of the bottle of water. And she starts pouring a little bit of it out into another container, and I think, oh, that's nice. She's going to give me that little bit. No. She hands me that liter of water with the ice chunk in it, and she says, here, sir. And it says in the gospel, if you give even a cup of water in my name to a little one, you shall not lose your reward. And so every time, sir, that you have a drink from this, I want you to praise the Lord. And I almost told her, I'm a Catholic. We don't do that sort of thing. But I didn't, and I took the water, and there I am, half an hour later, and I'm at the summit, and I'm sitting on the very top of this 4,000-foot elevation gain, and there's the range of the Cascades out there, and I've got a liter of ice water, and I'll tell you, there's more than just a song in my heart. There's an entire symphony that's echoing back and forth across that range and within me and in the goodness of that journey. That's my parable. And I'd just like to say, students, you don't need to have with you already, as you begin your journey, what you need for the hike that is your college education. You just need to start, and you need to ask along the way, and you'll find that your journey is transformed, and your heart will sing, and that you too will end up in a symphony. And parents, you too need to know that you don't need to have within you right now, at this moment, what you need by way of water for the journey of the next years of your life. All you need to do is to trust and to be willing to beg and to let your life be transformed by who you ask and how you walk and how your heart sings. And I pray, as a Jesuit priest, that all of us may be gathered again several years from now, and that we may truly indeed be a symphony for the journey we've taken and for how Seattle University has been an educational home for who we really are, whether students or parents or president. Thank you very much. I love that talk.